know it. This is my favorite group in the Miami Valley. I love to be here. And I'm grateful to be invited back. We've had so many journeys together and have shared. What?
How many years has it been?
Well, we moved here in 1991, and I believe, Larry, that you invited me the next year, 1992. Yes. Isn't that right?
At this point, my memory would not attest to any figure like that.
It's been a long time, and I found out right away where the best pastor in the Miami Valley was. I heard Larry give some astonishingly wonderful
presents. How did you get to know him?
I think he invited me here.
So we both
just asked who was the best New Testament prof in the entire southern region of the state of Ohio.
It's becoming quite a mutual admiration.
Right. Well, we did have a lot in common. We both went to school in Germany, and we had a good experience there and brought that with us. I'm just very glad to be back here and happy to turn with you all to examine the subject, Jesus Means Freedom. And Larry, you will recognize that I am appropriating the title of a book by the great Ernst Käsemann that was published back in, I think, 1970, maybe 1968. I woke up this morning early, checked my email, and when I do that, the news stories are scrolling across the screen, and the headline this morning, can you predict, was a hate-filled week in America. The bombings, many of those bombs were sent to people in New York City. The news organization CNN has its headquarters just a couple of blocks from the Manhattan campus of the university where I teach, Fordham. So the buildings were evacuated. And then yesterday, the attack on the synagogue. Another headline this morning, Brazil is about to have an election. And it looks from the polls that they are set to elect as their president a far right candidate who wants to return to the days of the military dictatorship in Brazil. Brazil watchers are describing the atmosphere surrounding that election with two words: anger and fear. Does that sound familiar? Right. And the rhetoric that is used by our politicians and then amplified often by the media that covers it and repeats it contributes to the polarization, right, of this moment in our life nationally. A couple of recent academic studies have concluded that churches and interfaith groups, like the one that's going to meet here on Wednesday, is that right?
A week from Wednesday.
A week from Wednesday. That these are among the few places left where people are able to come together across the deep divides in our society. Now, all of that, you won't be surprised to hear, all of that has driven me back to basics, back to the foundation, the bedrock of whatever faith has been given to me. And so that's the reason for our focus this fall. In the Epistle to the Galatians, Paul said, "For freedom, Christ has set us free. So don't go back to bondage." And the God of the Bible is the one who called a people out of bondage in Egypt. And it is the liberating dimensions of the ministry and the activity of Jesus that I'm inviting us to explore this fall. I would like to focus on the ways that Jesus sets us free. Free from complicity. And free from complacency, right? I'd like to focus on the way that the liberating action of Jesus makes us free to pursue peace with one another and justice in our society. And so we're going to be looking at Jesus' proclamation of liberty to the captives in that synagogue sermon that was the beginning of his public ministry. And then we're going to look at Jesus' healing ministry. Jesus' determination to liberate people from the terrible constraints upon the full humanity that was intended by God. So we're going to focus also on stories of exorcism. How did Jesus liberate people from the demons that still afflict our culture with so much fear and anger and hatred? And then we're going to talk about how Jesus went to Jerusalem and enacted God's reign, the liberation of the institutions of our society. And finally, we're going to talk about the resurrection. The resurrection as freedom from fear. It turns out that is crucial to the resurrection stories. So that's our agenda for the coming weeks together. And I'm so glad that you all invited me to come back and explore how the liberating action of Jesus can open our hearts and set us free. So I would like to begin at the beginning this morning with a story that's found in Matthew. Matthew chapter 2, verses 13 to 23. It's the story of the flight of Mary, Joseph, and Jesus first into Egypt, and then the return from Egypt. And I'd like to work through the text first, because it is full of such rich insights. At this point, where Matthew is not dependent upon Mark, where Matthew is able to tell the story with a free hand, Matthew shows us all of his artistry and his profound theology. So I'd like to start with that. Matthew chapter 2, verses 13 to 23. And I've got the New Greek Bible up here that my wife, look, it's not broken, it's not falling apart. This was my Christmas present. And so that we can follow what's going on in the Greek. It begins like this. Now, after they had departed, that's a reference to the wise men, right? The magi. After they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared, kat onar, in a dream, right? So it's not a waking vision. Joseph has a dream. An angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph, saying, get up and take the child and his mother and flee. The Greek word is fuge.
No, I should write it in Greek first. Fugue. Can you say that with me?
Fugue.
Yes. This is the technical word that is used for a flight into exile. I heard on the news this morning that two-thirds of the people of Honduras, and that's where the caravan started, right? Two-thirds of them are living in poverty. That the murder rate in the capital of Honduras is astronomically high. A lot of people from Latin America are my neighbors in the Bronx. I see them when I go to my office. Little women so small you can't imagine, carefully, lovingly shepherding their children to school first thing in the morning. So Jesus himself, right, has to flee. He flees into exile. So take the child and his mother and flee into Egypt. And you will remain there until I tell you. For Herod is about to seek the child to annihilate him, to destroy him. And Joseph arose, and he took the child and his mother at night, nuptos. And he went up country. That's the literal translation of the verb. He went up country into Egypt. And they were there until the death of Herod, so that it was fulfilled, the word of the Lord spoken by the prophet, saying, and this is, it's this quotation from Hosea, the prophet Hosea, that is the reason why this passage is the starting point for our exploration of freedom in Jesus. The word of the prophet spoken by the word of the Lord spoken by the prophet saying, out of Egypt I have called my son. Out of Egypt I've called my son. And then Herod, seeing that he had been infantilized. It's a literal translation. The Greek verb is built upon the word for a child. The Greek word pais, which means child. And literally, Matthew says that Herod noticed that the wise men had played with him like a child. They had infantilized him. They had tricked him. So Herod, beholding that he was infantilized by the wise men, ethumothe, he was full of thumos. Can you say that with me?
Thumos.
Yeah. This is the problem with our current political environment. Thumos means what?
Rage.
Anger. Literally, it's a hot feeling. A burning in the chest, right? This is what Achilles feels in the Iliad when Agamemnon takes his woman away. And that's the beginning of so much violence and sorrow for the Greeks. Thumos. So Herod was full of much rage or anger. And he sent, in order to destroy all of the children in Bethlehem and in all the regions round about her, all of those who were less than, younger than 2 years, according to the time that he had ascertained from the Magi. And then was fulfilled what was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet, saying, a voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and wailing a great deal. Rachel crying for her children, and it was not possible for her to be comforted, for the children are not. You see, much as in our time, the anger, the rage, right, and the fear issues forth into what? Death. Violence. The loss of a whole generation of children in Bethlehem. So when Herod had died, behold, an angel of the Lord again appears in a dream to Joseph when he was in Egypt, saying, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go into the land of Israel. For those people who were seeking the life of the child are dead." And getting up, he took the child and the mother, and they went into Israel. But hearing that Archelaus had become king of the Jews in the place of his father, he, that is Joseph, was afraid to go there. And being warned again in a dream, he went up country. So another flight, another migrant story. He went up country into the parts of Galilee, not Bethlehem, not Judea. And going there, he settled. He made a home in a little place, a little city called Nazareth. And thus was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet, that he shall be called a Nazarene, or a Nazarean. The first and most obvious thing to point out is that the three dreams that Joseph has, the dreams that save the life of the child and then bring him back home, those three dreams make it clear that God's hand and God's plan stands over the action. And that's something we have to remind ourselves of in this terrible moment. I think I inherited from my mother a propensity to worry. I was with you all here. You remember when she was passing and you helped me work through my grief? But like her, I worry a lot. And I'm anxious. And when I panic, I look back on that and it occurs to me that God was with me. I just couldn't see it. Do you have that experience too? Of becoming anxious and panicking and forgetting that God's hand is upon your life. That we are in God's hands. So that's one thing that the text wants to make clear by means of the three dreams. God's hand and God's plan stands over the destiny of Jesus. Now, that crucial verse, "Out of Egypt I have called my son," Hosea chapter 11. The first thing that that verse tells us is that the story of Jesus that is about to unfold in the Gospel of Matthew and that will unfold here as we work together, that story recapitulates, it repeats and fulfills the story of Israel. Israel's exodus. Israel's liberation from bondage in Egypt. Matthew wants to tell us, to tell his readers, that salvation was not just a one-time event. It can happen again. It can happen anew. Matthew's point is that just as God called Israel out of Egypt, God calls Jesus out of Egypt. The story of salvation begins again. It begins anew. Now, in this story, Egypt is polyvalent. It has more than one meaning. First of all, for Joseph and Mary and the child, Egypt is a place of refuge. It's a place where the life of the child is saved. And we are reminded that in the history of Israel, Jacob and his sons in Palestine were suffering from what?
Famine.
A famine. Exactly. Give you A+ for today. There was a famine in the land, and their lives were at stake. And it was God, through another dreamer, another person named
Joseph,
who saved the people of Israel by taking them down into Egypt. They went to a place called Goshen, the land that was given to them. And there they survived. And we are probably meant by Matthew to remember that before he died, the patriarch Jacob extracted a promise from his sons. What was that promise? That they would not, yes, that they would not bury him where?
In
Egypt. That they would bury him back home in the land of promise. Matthew probably assumes that we will remember that. But we cannot forget that Egypt eventually became a place of enslavement. That's right. I'm sure it happened in stages, as it has for us. It probably started with compliance, right? Under the force of Pharaoh's decree that the Israelites should do what? Build the pyramids. Make bricks. And so they did what they had to do. They complied with the power. My older son, who is so full of justice and idealism, in the last couple of years have been very hard for him. And I've watched him go through stages of grief and frustration. He started looking for a job outside the United States. That's how disappointed he is with the direction that our country is going. And sure enough, guess what happened? He got a job outside the United States. He and his wife are moving to England in December. But I've also watched the initial outrage, the death of some of his ideals, work its way into a certain amount of compliance. And then before long, compliance becomes complacency. You know, you become complacent with the compromises that you've made. And finally, complacency, it turns into complicity. So, those are probably the stages of enslavement in the history of Israel. Exodus chapter 32 tells the story of the golden calf. When Israel is brought out of enslavement, out of Egypt by God, and they've wandered for some time in the wilderness to Mount Sinai, Moses goes up the mountain to receive the tablets of the law. And while he is gone, what do the people of Israel do? They make a golden calf. An animal god. Like the animal gods of Egypt. And they worship it. And there are a couple of texts that I want to point out that are part of the story I think Matthew is trying to tell. And these texts may surprise you as much as they did me when I first looked at them. Numbers chapter 11, verses 2 to 4. Now, among the people of Israel, the crowd, they had a strong craving. And the Israelites wept and they said, if only we had meat to eat. They've been eating manna for a while, that flaky substance that they could pick up off of the ground every morning. But that wasn't enough. If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish that we used to eat in Egypt for nothing. The cucumbers, the melons, I hope you've had breakfast, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our strength is dried up, and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at. Ancient cream of wheat. Do you see what has happened here? Do you see what's happened here? The great Old Testament scholar, Walter Brueggemann, good Lutheran, he...
Anglican, no.
Anglican, no. Yes, you're right. He describes what had happened to the people of Israel during the time of their enslavement. He describes it very poignantly as Pharaoh in the soul. Right? They had internalized Pharaoh. And the text here diagnoses the psychological mechanism. It was a craving, a desire for more, a desire for more than God provided, that led them. And look how the world gets turned upside down. Look how perverted things appear. They begin to long for the meat, the fish that they ate, and the cucumbers and the leeks back in Egypt, and they cry out and say, we ate that food for what?
Nothing.
And yet, they were what?
Slaves.
Those were slaves' rations. But their perception is now so perverted, right? The process of enslavement, their complicity with it, their craving for more has turned everything upside down. Here's another passage that I looked back at in an effort to understand the story that Matthew is recapitulating. This is from Numbers chapter 16. And it's the account of the rebellion against God, rebellion against Moses, led by three men, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And I just want you to hear what they say, these three rebel leaders. They say to Moses, is it too little that you have brought us up out of, wait for it, out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in this wilderness? The land flowing with milk and honey should be what? The promised land where they're going. But now their values are so perverted, turned around, backwards, upside down. The land of milk and honey is where in their minds? Egypt. Where they were slaves. See, this is the work that we have to do here together, right? in the coming weeks. If we're going to follow Jesus in his liberating ministry, if we're going to free ourselves of Pharaoh in the soul, there is a really good book by a professor at the University of Chicago. This book has helped me a lot. His name is Eric Santner. And the title of the book, it's a little book, you could read it in one afternoon. It's called On the Psychotheology of Everyday Life. Pretty good title, isn't it? I wish I'd thought of that. Maybe I'd sell a few books. On the Psychotheology of Everyday Life. And here's what he says. He's trying to understand this craving that the biblical text talks about. By the way, Paul, in the version of when Paul retells the story of Israel in the wilderness, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 6, Paul focuses on that, you know, psychologist that he is, Paul focuses on that craving. They craved with a strong craving, and that's why they fell into idol worship and sexual immorality. Well, Eric Santner picks up where Paul left off in analyzing this psychological mechanism that keeps us enslaved. And here's what Santner says. He goes back to Augustine and to Luther. Augustine, in his book that describes his conversion, Augustine says, and Augustine is talking about his own craving as a young person. This is in the Confessions, right? The Confessions is a long communication of Augustine with whom? God. The whole book is addressed to God. Oh God, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find rest in you. That's the first sentence of the Confessions. We should all read it again. And Augustine is trying to understand why he was not, as a young person, satisfied with everything that God was providing through his loving Christian mother, Monica. Why was he still obsessed with strong desires, cravings? Augustine tells the story of how there was a fruit tree that overhung a garden wall. And what did he do? You remember? He stole the fruit from his neighbor's tree, and he then explains, we had lots of good fruit trees in our own yard. Why did I steal from the neighbor? And here's what Augustine says. Augustine says that the mechanism of desire is incurvatus a se. Latin students, incurvatus, turned back, upon se, upon oneself. That's what Augustine confesses to God. He says, that was the root of my craving. It was ultimately selfishness. It was a turning away from God, a turning away from others. Well, that's what Eric Santner's book, little book, is about. He's trying to figure out, how do we get out of the prison house of what? The ego. How do we break this self-seeking bondage, right? This craving that is ultimately a seeking of ourselves. Is there any way out of the prison house of the ego? And Santner argues that it is the gift, it is the grace of the others that we meet every day who are calling us out of ourselves. That's why he calls it the psychotheology of what? Everyday life. That might be, he thinks, a way out of the slavery to the self. Well, Matthew says that the story of Jesus recapitulates and fulfills the story of Israel. And so we are not able to forget that the journey through the wilderness was, the journey to the promised land was difficult, dangerous. It took how long? 40 years. How many people of those who originally came out of Egypt and were filled with the craving for what they had left behind, for more than God provided, how many of those people actually made it to the promised land?
Two.
Their names were?
Joshua
and Caleb. Even Moses didn't make it in. He looked over into the promised land from the heights of Mount Nebo, and God buried him there. When I was a little boy, my father read Hulbert's Bible story book to us every night before we fell asleep. And every year when we went through the cycle and we came to the death of Moses and the account of how God buried Moses, like a child would bury a pet bird, in a cave on Mount Nebo, I just wept as a child. Eric Santner describes the thing from which we need to liberate ourselves, the thing that is keeping us enslaved. This is such a great description. Egyptomania. Isn't that great? Egyptomania. And I know that I suffer from it, right? On many levels. If I were writing my own confessions, you know, I would tell you that I have not given myself as fully as I should have to others in need because I was chasing after academic honors, right? This past March, I published my 10th book. 2 days ago, I published my 11th book. Now, wouldn't you think 10 would have been enough? Why did I need that extra one? Why didn't I give myself more fully? And I keep going back to that soup kitchen that Diane and I started in New Haven, Connecticut. How many years ago was that? That was 40 years ago. And I've never done anything like that. Not like that. Since. Egyptomania, chasing after academic honors. And then I could give you more trivial examples. The little car that carries me back and forth to New York every week is the smallest and cheapest car you can buy. It doesn't even have cruise control, so that I'm developing bursitis, truck driver's disease. And when I turn on television, I see that there is now for sale here in the United States a car called Giulia, manufactured by Alfa Romeo. Have you seen the ads?
No.
Oh, the most seductive female voice, right? Tells you how wonderful it's going to be. Egyptomania. Craving. Egyptomania. I mean, the journey to freedom, the journey out of bondage, means getting Pharaoh out of the soul. It means disenthralling ourselves. That's the only good thing about the wilderness, right? Is that it is a place where, and that's where we are now, as a people, and all around the world, right? hatred and anger rising. It's a wilderness now. And the good thing that might happen is that in this terrible time, we might begin to reassess, to disenthrall ourselves, to deal with our Egyptomania. But the biblical text doesn't hide the truth from us. The journey out of Egypt, the journey to the Promised Land, is difficult and dangerous. Just think of everything they endured on the way. Hunger, thirst, disease, the plague. But you remember, in every case, God provided. When they were hungry, He provided what?
Manna.
And when the manna wasn't enough, He provided what?
Quail,
my favorite food. I grew up in the hills of northern Mississippi, and on the Thanksgiving table, nobody touched the turkey. We all went for the quail, those wonderful little birds. And when the people of Israel were thirsty, God told Moses to bring forth water from what?
A rock.
And Paul says that rock followed Israel through the wilderness. God kept on providing water. And when disease struck, God told Moses to do what? Put a serpent up on a staff. Whoever looks at it will what?
Live.
So the journey out of enslavement, the journey out of Egyptomania, is difficult and dangerous. And like Israel, we will endure a lot of things on the way. But we need to remind ourselves that God provides. Now, the most important lesson is still ahead of us. Matthew tells us that when Joseph, Mary, and the child returned, or were about to return to Nazareth, Archelaus was ruling in his father's place. And so they were afraid to go back to Judea, and instead they went where? Galilee. But if you keep reading Matthew's gospel, who was ruling Galilee? Herod Antipas. The one who beheaded whom? John the Baptist. And the one who was eventually part of the trial that led to the death of Jesus. So Matthew foreshadows the fact that even the return to the Promised Land is not going to be without difficulty and danger. Okay, let me conclude with this. How do we start? How do we start the journey to freedom? How do we start the exodus from Egyptomania and the journey to the Promised Land of freedom and justice? The key, I believe, is found in the verse of Hosea that Matthew quotes. Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. Out of Egypt I have called my son. Now, I went back and looked at that verse in context. See, Matthew was a Jewish Christian, and he's always got the context in his mind when he is quoting a text. And so if you go to Hosea chapter 11, verse 1, it begins like this. When Israel was a child, God is speaking, when Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. I did a little research on this. The verb that Hosea uses here to describe God's emotion is the verb ahav. Can you say that with me?
Ahav.
When Israel was a child, I loved him. Do you No. Did you know that this is the first Old Testament text that gives as the motive for God's liberation of Israel love? The first one. Older text in the Hebrew Bible, for example, the prophet Amos. Amos used another word to describe God's election of Israel. It's the verb yadah. Can you say that with me?
Yadah.
Which means to know. So Amos says that God knew Israel, right? It's that verb of knowledge that is used for the election, the choice of Israel. Hosea is the first one who says that God's election and God's liberation of the people was motivated not by knowledge of them, but by what?
Love.
Hosea is the first one to describe the liberation of Israel as being on account of the love of Yahweh. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And then if you keep reading Hosea 11, the picture just gets more beautiful. It was I, God says, who taught Ephraim how to walk. I took them in my arms. Chapter 3, verses 8 and 9. Listen to this. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bands of love. I was to them like those who lift infants to their cheeks. I bent down to them and fed them. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over? Well, I think that's the key for us. Where do we begin? How do we start the journey out of Egypt, out of enslavement to our selfish desires? It begins in that moment when we know ourselves as what? Loved by God. That's where it starts. When we know that we are deeply and truly loved. Jesus eventually left the carpenter's bench. Luke says he was how old? 30-something. About 30. And he went to the Jordan River and stepped in and started his liberating work. Do you remember what he heard? A voice. He heard a voice that spoke out of heaven. It spoke to him. Do you remember what the voice said? You are my son. My what?
Beloved.
My beloved. That's where freedom starts. That's what he heard the voice say. You are my son. My beloved. He knew himself to be so deeply loved. And the knowledge that the other, the great other, other with a capital O, loved him, began to set Jesus free from love of self. The prison house of the ego began to open. He could give himself to others because he knew himself to be what? So deeply loved. I can't resist telling you just quickly the story of how that truth came home to me. It was a hard journey for me from the intellectual wilderness of Mississippi to Yale University and the beginning of my work as a teacher of New Testament. The person who started that for me was an old Jewish woman. My high school English teacher. She called me up to her desk one day and she said, Larry, you can do better than your parents think you can. And so she wrote letters for me and got me into Yale University. And then she called me up to her desk after class in my senior year. She said, there's a smart redheaded girl in my other class. You should ask her out. I've been married to her for 40 years. When I got to Yale, she knew I would be frightened and lonely, that I might panic. Right? I carried a dictionary around with me secretly in my pocket at Yale because I didn't even understand the English words that people were using. So she knew that's what I would face. And so this old Jewish lady wrote me a letter every week. And I kept them. I was in my first teaching job at McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago, and the phone rang one day, and it was someone calling from my hometown to tell me that Mrs. Miller, my English teacher, had died. She died at her desk in school, thankfully before the children came in, had a massive heart attack. She had one cup of coffee too many. As T.S. Eliot said, she measured out her life in coffee spoons. Well, when I got that news, I went to the little closet in my office in Chicago and I got out the shoebox in which I had kept all of her letters. And I untied the package and I started reading through the letters. And I'd read several letters and the phone rang again. And it was that redhead calling to ask me if I'd heard the news about Mrs. Miller's death. And Diane must have been able to tell that I'd been crying. She said, Larry, are you okay? And I said to her, you know, it's strange. I said, for the first time in my life, if someone were to say to me, here, you can have your whole life back, just as you have lived it. The bad things and the good things. For the first time in my life, I would say yes. I would take it all back, just as it was. Now, that feeling faded, and I've never felt that way since. But I do know what that's like, right? For a few minutes, I knew what that's like. To be able to say yes to everything that God has given me in my life. How did I come to that point? It was because I knew myself to be what?
Loved.
So deeply loved by somebody. So, just as it was for Jesus and for Israel, when Israel was a child, God says, I loved him. I lifted him up to my face as the way people pick up infants. So that, I think, I would submit to you that that is where the journey to freedom starts for us. We can get Pharaoh out of our souls. We can get rid of our Egyptomania. We can move into the freedom that God intended for us. Freedom from fear and anger, and worry and anxiety. And it begins, the first step on the journey is knowing that we are deeply loved. Well, that's what I wanted to share with you today. You may have questions, comments. For next time, we're going to take the next step with Jesus. As you know, he goes to the synagogue in his hometown and announces the liberation of the captives. And it is that synagogue sermon, right? The proclamation of freedom in the Gospel of Luke. We're going to look at Luke's version of that. That will be our focus next Sunday. Do we have time? Questions? Comments? I know everyone else had to go. I guess to the choir.
Choir.
Yes, Jim.
How long were they in Egypt?
40. Oh, how long were they in Egypt? Generations.
No, I mean Jesus and Joseph.
Oh, Jesus and Joseph and Mary. I don't know. I don't really know. There are so few markers, right? Chronological markers. Luke's the only one who tells us that Jesus was 12 years old when his parents took him to the temple, and that he was about 30 when he left the carpenter's bench. Matthew doesn't give us any chronological markers except that Herod killed all the children that were what? Under 2 years old. But we don't know how long they were in Egypt. I guess we could make a guess. We could calculate. If we assume, okay, if we assume that Jesus was born in about 6 BC, that's what most scholars think, then we could calculate down to the death of Herod. I'm going to have to look this up. Does anyone have Google? See if you can Google, when did Herod the Great die? Then, Jim, this is a great question. This is a great question. How long were they in Egypt? While we're waiting for help from Google, can I just tell you that in the apocryphal Gospels, Gospels that didn't make it into the New Testament, there are stories about the little boy Jesus in Egypt. There are stories like that. And those stories put him there as a child, right? Not yet a teenager, but a child.
When BC.
He died in 4 BC?
Chronic kidney disease.
Thank you so much. So it looks like they were only there for what?
2 years.
Yes.
Well, how would Joseph have, as a Jew in Egypt, with Mary and Jesus, how would he have supported himself?
Thank you. I'm going to answer that question on two levels. First of all, the economic level, right? So we don't know for sure whether he would have found work. Maybe he found work as a carpenter. That's what he was. What we do know is that there was a large Jewish community in Egypt. Alexandria was the largest Jewish population in the world outside of Jerusalem. Almost one-third of the population of Alexandria was Jewish in the first century. It was the New York City of the ancient world. There were Jews in the countryside, too. There was even a Jewish temple in the countryside. Did you know that? Yeah. Some people believed that's where the Ark of the Covenant was hidden. In that Egyptian Jewish temple. And there were Jews in Egypt right down until recently. Do you know the story of the black Jews? They left Egypt and they now live in Israel. Do you know about this, Jim? Yeah, you can Google this too for us if you want to. The black Jews. Right. So, no, there was a significant Jewish population, not only in Alexandria, but also in the countryside. And they had their own temple. So, Jesus, Joseph, and Mary would have probably been part of an immigrant community. The very people that now are in danger of being blocked at the border or sent back. We've already seen children separated from their parents. Well, we've made a start, right? I hope you think it was a good start. Please come back next time. If you want to read ahead, read that synagogue sermon in Luke. It is so good. Thank you.
Thank you. I forgot to give you coffee. What do you like in your coffee for next week?
Oh. A latte or a cappuccino. I'm really terrible. Cryptomania.
Great. I'm a latte for me. So both of them have
lots of green?
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
All those questions.
Okay.
I've got to teach myself how to. Oh, here we go. Stop.